From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident curmudgeon, analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
And later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Carl Racine. He is the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Joining us now is Chris Geldart, D.C.'s Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. Chris Geldart, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kojo. Good afternoon to you and to Tom.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to what's happening in Washington, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Virginia. And of course, the big political news there is the upcoming election, and in particular, the governor's race. The two candidates finally squared off, Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, and Democrat Terry McAuliffe. It has been described by Laura Vozella and Gregory Schneider in the Washington Post as a contentious bare-knuckled debate, which seemed like a fairly masculine way of describing it, but apparently it was, as you viewed, quite contentious.
Yes, I did watch it, and it was what one of them called a slugfest. I looked at media coverage of it around the state, and it was two men battling it out, a couple of insults, personal insults along the way. But the important thing to note is it's the first debate they've had in this campaign, because Mr. Youngkin, the Republican, has declined to participate in several others. There's one more on September 28th at the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, I believe, in NBC4. But the debate was no Virginia gentleman's back and forth. There were about three issues I would just briefly mention because I think it was really important. On vaccine mandates, Republican Glenn Youngkin stuck to his position that he's vaccinated, he thinks you should be vaccinated, but he's not willing to order or tell people they must be vaccinated. And so it's a freedom of choice issue for him. As you noted, I said on a Twitter account, you know, this is not a menu selection, this is a public health crisis.
I noted that.
But, and Terry McAuliffe said he's for mandates. The former governor trying to regain the office says he's a moderate liberal, and he thinks that people should be vaccinated. He asked Mr. Youngkin, would you tell a nurse in a critical care ward, cancer ward, that she or he must be vaccinated in order to be in there with immune-compromised cancer patients? And Mr. Youngkin stuck to his, I would hope she would, but he's not going to tell her to do so. On abortion, again, very different positions. The news made there was Republican Glenn Youngkin said for the first time that he would not support a Texas-style abortion bill that's now the subject of the nation.
Even though in a meeting long before this, he had indicated that he would have to, I guess, shape his views or contain his real views on abortion in order to win more middle-of-the-road independence.
Yes, Democrat Terry McAuliffe brought that up in July. He had, an activist group had caught Mr. Youngkin saying that he would be much more, he'd go on the offensive after he wins on abortion, but he couldn't really say how his views were because they would not attract independent voters. And finally, on election integrity, this is another change, particularly for Mr. Youngkin. He started his campaign, having been endorsed by Donald Trump now, I think, three times, saying he was worried about election integrity in the state of Virginia. He created a task force to watch the election to make certain things are going to go all right and to review the 2020 election. But last night, when asked if he would accept the results in the November 2nd election, Mr. Youngkin and Mr. McAuliffe both said yes, they would accept the results. So that was pretty interesting, all of that. I would recommend to people in Virginia, if you're a voter, and again, voting open today, is to look it up on Google. Try to Google and find the debate. It's an interesting debate. You'll clearly see two different candidates.
Do you suggest that Chris Geldart should also watch this debate? Chris Geldart, are you interested in this issue?
I think Mr. Geldart, the deputy mayor, I think has a full plate right here in our District of Columbia.
Well, I was hoping
that is true.
I was hoping to draw him out on the Virginia governor's race, but that's not going to happen. But as Tom Sherwood indicated, Chris Geldart.
It's like throwing a dart at a bunch of gales.
Chris, what's his name? Is DC's deputy mayor for public safety and justice. Last night, WSA 9 reported that there have been online threats from the alt-right ahead of tomorrow's rally. So let's start with today. Chris Geldart, what can you tell us about what we should expect today?
You know, I'm actually down here in the area right now, Kodjo, and it's quiet. People are going about their normal business down here around the mall and the Capitol. You know, we had reports that there may have been some folks come in early. We have seen some folks in the city wearing the attire of the groups that are coming in to express their First Amendment rights. But to date and to now, there's been no serious show or anything that we need to be concerned about at this point.
How about the show of force? What does security look like around the Capitol today?
Sure. So the fence around the Capitol that's purely on the Capitol grounds went up and was in place last night. So this morning that was in place. The jersey barriers and the things that are being used to make sure we have a space for those that are coming to express their opinions were set up. We made sure that both within the city and on the Capitol, in working in conjunction with Capitol Police, we had folks on the ready today in case anything did show up. And then, as you know, tomorrow we'll be at an all hands on deck with our law enforcement agencies, and the Capitol has brought in many of our regional partners to help them.
Mr. Geldart, where precisely is this rally? As we know, on January 6th, when things turned into a riot, there was quite a bit of action on the east side of the Capitol, on the Capitol Hill side, and then on the mall side, on the west side. Where is the permit for, if people want to avoid the area or reporters want to go, like me, where is it? Right precisely at the bottom of the Capitol Hill on the, at the mall? Where is it?
It is, sir. It's actually the permit space they have is just in front of the reflecting pool, or between 3rd Street and the reflecting pool for the Capitol. Okay. So there's the area right there that they've been permitted for.
I know that the Capitol Hill Police, and maybe you're going to be involved in a 1 o'clock news conference about what to expect tomorrow with all the people working together. But I want to ask you, it's that some expectations of the crowd will be big, but the most I've heard from the various security people I've spoken to is that the crowd may not be that big, may certainly not as big as January 6th. But the real worry is that one or two or a half dozen lone wolves, that is people acting on their own to do some kind of serious damage, could come to the city and disrupt things, be violent. How concerned are you about lone wolf demonstrators they're not demonstrators, people causing violence, as opposed to the big crowd that's coming tomorrow?
Sure. You know, our DC values, as the mayor says all the time, and I concur and echo, we don't tolerate hate or people who refuse to accept the results of elections or those rejecting accountability for criminal actions that were committed on the 6th. And, you know, those type of lone wolf acts that you're talking about, Tom, are people that are looking for violence, and those are things that we don't tolerate here. We're always on the lookout and concern for those lone wolf type of acts. We've got a lot of law enforcement presence, you know, that which will be seen and unseen for this weekend, as we do for all major events that we have. So, you know, we're going to be keeping our eye out. I don't want to go into to Chief Conte's deep tactics on this, but that's something that we take very seriously and are on constant watch for, both locally here and with our federal partners.
And unlike January 6th, the D.C. National Guard, which is called up by the Secretary of the Army, not the mayor, at least not yet, the D.C. National Guard, unlike January 6th, has been called up and is on standby. Is that correct?
That's correct. They're in a quick reaction force status, so they'll be at the National Guard Armory, but they are on standby in case the Capitol Police need any additional support on the Hill.
And if Kojo will let me, one last thing for me.
I won't. If you have questions, no, go ahead.
One last thing for me, the fence. You know, I've been very clear on this program, as others have been, that we don't need a permanent fencing around the Capitol. Do you, and does Mayor Bowser, do you have views on whether or not this temporary fencing should become permanent? Would you support maybe just always having to be removed and not have a permanent fence around the Capitol? What's your view?
Yeah, I think in our conversations, Tom, around this event, it was very clear, working with the new chief at the Capitol and the our other federal partners, that the fence going up for this event is one that goes up on Thursday and it comes down on Sunday, or when they feel that it's safe. to bring it back down. So I think that's a good posture for them to do when they believe it's necessary to have additional security practices in place. I don't think any of us as American citizens and residents want to see a fence around our Capitol. So, you know, I think they have the right posture now, which is, you know, there may be, and out of abundance of caution, they're going to put up the additional security measure and they're going to take it down when they believe that that's secure.
Chris, it's my understanding there's going to be a counter protest as well. What can you tell us about that? And are you concerned about issues between the two groups? We're not talking about a lone wolf here, but other demonstrations who are, I guess, who can be expected to be at least verbally hostile towards the demonstrators who are coming to the Capitol.
Yeah, there are some folks that have said, several groups that have said they're going to come down and do counter-protest. You know, they're planning their demonstrations, some around Union Square Plaza, some of them starting off down by Freedom Plaza. The way that this was set up for the permit and the way that law enforcement is working on this is intentional to keep separation between the groups. You know, that is a concern, of course, if the groups mix. So the activities of law enforcement, I believe, once the rallies come to an end, which is just about 3:30 in the afternoon, will be to make sure that we're keeping some distance between those that have come to express their First Amendment rights and those that have come to express their First Amendment rights against the other group.
Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger said it simply that we will support your right to protest, but we will react strongly if there's any violence.
And, of course, we did mention earlier, or you did mention earlier, that you did not want to reveal Chief Conte's strategy, but how has your office been working with U.S. Capitol Police to prepare for this day, and what kind of coordination is going on?
Sure. And, Kojo, as you and Tom both know, we have a long history in the city of coordination with our federal partners. You know, we're continuing that coming off of January 6th. And when I came into the office of deputy mayor, it was one of my first real charges with all of our district agencies that work the security for the city. To re-engage with our federal partners and reset and ensure that in everything, whether it's sharing information, sharing intelligence, working in the streets, that we've got that coordination and good collaboration going on. We've had several meetings with Capitol Police, the Park Police, our federal partners from Secret Service and the FBI, all of the usual entities that we work with here in the city, just to reset that relationship and making sure that we're all doing what we need to do to keep our nation's capital safe.
This is a perfect time, although it's not about tomorrow's event, a perfect time to talk about the forensic lab, which has had trouble for months or longer. It lost its accreditation to inspect guns used in crimes this week. All 11 members of the firearms examination unit were dismissed, told they were not going to, they'll be paid through sometime in October, but they were walked out the door.
This after the crime lab lost its accreditation perform forensic testing.
So what's happening there? Is there going to be a new firearm examination unit? Are you going to outsource that to the federal government? What's the plan there?
Sure, and that's a great question, Tom, and I appreciate being able to talk about.
All my questions are great.
The progress that we're making with our forensics lab. You know, we brought in outside experts to work with us to really just dig in across the entire spectrum of the lab, all of the work that it does, to make sure that we have lost accreditation. So as we build back to that accreditation point, what are all the things that we need to make sure we're doing appropriately? With the appropriate people. And when it comes to the firearms unit, there's so much there that we needed to get into and untie. And the fact that the work of that firearms unit is outsourced right now to the ATF and to some contractors.
Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
And firearms, yes, sir. So we're working closely with them as well as some outside contractors. That won't come back in-house for quite some time. Because we want to make sure that we have everything we need to is correct. We're looking at many labs across the country that are very successful, the policies, procedures, SOPs, all that kind of stuff that they use. we want to make sure that we have the best of the best in our lab once we're done doing this restructure.
I would just say I have heard from some people who support D.C. statehood saying it's not a good sign if the city, the district is going to contract out such a critical issue on crime, given the crime we have now in the city, violent crime, to give it over to the federal government. It's not a good statehood moment. But go ahead.
So that's not the intent, is not to have the ATF do this for the long term. It really was a short term, and actually the ATF have some of the best gun forensic labs in the country. So a lot of the things that we're learning from them, the standard operating procedures, some of the new procedures that are out and new equipment that the ATF is using is greatly benefiting our capacity as we rebuild. The intent is not to keep that long term. The intent is hopefully at some point we bring it back in, or if we decide to continue it in a contract basis, it would be with a private contractor.
Our guest is Chris Geldart. He is D.C.'s Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice. Here's Joanne in Washington, D.C. Joanne, your turn.
Hi, Kojo, and thank you for taking my call. Also, the D.C. Deputy of Public Safety regarding the rally plan for tomorrow. I live down the street from it and had a couple questions. First, this additional protection, D.C. police cost D.C. taxpayers, I believe, and businesses money. Shouldn't they have to put up some kind of deposit is one idea. And also why the D.C. Attorney General, who I believe comes on later, why we can't sue these organizations, domestic terrorists, on behalf of Capitol Hill residents for kind of threatening the neighborhood and the businesses that are losing money, that sort of thing.
I'm glad to see that you're keeping up with our guest list. You know who's coming on next. But in terms of the questions for Chris Geldart, I'll put the first question to you, Chris, and that is, Joanne wants to know why the organizers of these demonstrations shouldn't be made to pay some money up front just to defray some of the costs that could emanate from this.
So, Joanne, thank you for the question. It's a very valid question that you ask. And in the city, when we do special events, there are many special events that we do through our Mayor Special Events Task Group where the organizers do have to pay for certain things to happen, such as overtime for certain agencies, cleanup, things like that. But when we're talking about First Amendment events, truly First Amendment events, those are ones that are not covered under our Mayor's Special Events Task Group per se when it comes to any kind of fees, because it is people coming to their nation's capital to express their First Amendment rights. And, you know, it is incumbent on us as the District of Columbia to support our federal partners here in ensuring that their people can come here and peacefully express their First Amendment rights. You know, we do as city agencies, so the overtime that we'll be doing for this, the additional vehicle costs and things like that, there is a payment that the district receives from the federal government to help defray those costs for the DC agencies. But that doesn't include our businesses. And that's, you know, a very valid point that you bring. You know, our businesses do or may at times see things that happen where they are affected by some of the protests that go on. And I think it's a great question for our Attorney General on, you know, in times like that, how do we recoup?
Yeah, just hand it off to Carl Racine.
Who's coming up next?
Thank you very much for your call, Joanne. Here now is Mickey in Severn, Maryland. Mickey, your turn.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for doing this show. I've attended many demonstrations in past, and we've always been advised never to bring anything that could be construed as a weapon, including, say, a stick to hold up a placard or, you know, a sign. And I was just wondering, I've seen on the some of the promo for this event that demonstrators have been told to bring flags. And I was wondering if they have been advised not to bring any flag poles that can be used and were used in the last demonstration as weapons.
Chris Geldart.
Sure. And that's again, very valid point. You know, there is, when they get a permit, when people get a permit to do First Amendment events on federal property. There is a list of things that they are asked to abide by. And so that's an extensive list. You know, and I think there, I don't know what the Capitol Hill's list is, but I know that for the Park Service, they have a list of things that can and can't be. I don't have that list right in front of me, but I couldn't tell you whether flagpoles are a part of that or not. But I know that list does cover just about anything that can be construed or used as a weapon.
If they weren't before January 6th, they should be after January 6th have been included. And finally from, well, not really finally, but next is Kathy from Chevy Chase, who sent us an email. What will be the most reliable ways for people to keep informed about situation updates and changes and instructions for people if that is necessary as events progress tomorrow? I'd give you Tom Sherwood's Twitter handle, but you can figure that out for yourself.
At Tom Sherwood.
But here's Chris.
Sure. I think if I could, Kojo, expound on that for a second. We do really do rely on the public also to help keep us informed. That see something, say something. It's been around for quite some time. And residents and visitors that are here play a pivotal role in letting us know that things are going on. So if folks see an emergency, please dial 911 immediately. And if you wanted to report suspicious behavior, you think you see something that shouldn't be happening, they can go on and use MPD's iWatch, which is iWatch, the word watch, DC.org, or they can text MPD anonymously at 50411. Those are some ways that people can report. Now, how do you get information back on things that are going on? That's our Alert DC system that we have in place. It's been in place for a very long time. It's our official communication system that allows folks to pick the types of information they want to receive when they get on there. And they can sign up for that at alert.dc.gov.
Bottom line on this, on January the 6th, the Capitol Hill police, for whatever reasons, were not prepared for the violence that occurred that day, and it complicated DC police, National Guard helping. Are you confident whatever happens tonight and for tomorrow into the weekend that this time around everyone is ready?
I am confident, Tom, that we have all the coordination and collaboration in place for this event. We have very clearly shared all information around this event with all of the partners. We've had many meetings at multiple different levels for coordination and collaboration. So I think that, you know, given the size of crowd that in even on the outset.
And I think you're breaking up at this point. I don't know if you can still hear me. We only have about a minute left. I got a tweet from Beth who said there's an art installation on the National Mall memorializing people who have died from COVID-19. I know Tom is excited about that. It's likely many folks attending this demonstration will be hostile to anything pandemic. I assume district law enforcement and National Park Police will be ready to protect that memorial. Care to comment on that, Chris? Cutting out again. But Chris Gellert is the Deputy Mayor of the District of Columbia for Public Safety and Justice. Thank you so much for joining us, Tom. I'm sure you intend on checking out that memorial this
weekend. Yeah, 600, I'm going to go this afternoon after the show. 660,000 white flags representing the people who have died in the COVID pandemic.
So you'll know where to find Tom this afternoon if you'd like to start a conversation with him. Joining us next is Carl Racine, the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. If you have questions or comments for Carl Racine, you can start calling now. 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. Joining us now is Carl Racine, the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Carl Racine, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Kojo. Hey, Tom.
Before we get to talking about what the Attorney General is doing, Tom Sherwood. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Montgomery County, more specifically Tacoma Park. Everybody who's passed through Tacoma Park probably knows that there's a co-op on Carroll Avenue that every resident of Tacoma Park seems to go to.
It's required by citizenship to go there.
But right next to that co-op is a large parking lot, and there has been a plan put forward by developers to build a building on that parking lot, and a lot of people support it, but a lot of people maybe even more seem to object to it. However, Montgomery planners have decided to give the developers more time for the proposal, and that a name that has come up in this is the name of the Maryland comptroller, Peter Francher, who one seems to suggest might be opposed to this.
Well, this could be just a routine case of NIMBYism, but it's not. The state controller, Mr. Francho, lives around the corner from this project, and he's been known to oppose the plans to develop that project and cut into the side of the property for a loading zone, essentially. And it's been back and forth in the discussions. The State Highway Department apparently has approved it, and the developers were getting the planning department in Montgomery County to give them more time to persuade the State Highway Department to change its mind. The wrinkle comes with Mr. Francho is that he has met at least twice, I believe it was, with state highway officials and expressed the concerns that he and the other citizens have about this loading zone area that would be created. And some of the people who got emails disclosing these meetings have suggested it's improper for the comptroller to be injecting himself into this subject. There's been no indication in any story that I've seen of anything wrong that he in fact did. It's just the appearance that did he use his power as one of the most powerful people in the state government to lean on the State Highway Department? Well, the answer to that at this moment is, well, no, they haven't changed their mind, and there's no indication that they will. So that's where we are, a NIMBY matter writ large in a very politically attuned neighborhood.
Mr. Attorney General, earlier in the broadcast, we were talking, of course, with the Deputy Mayor for Public Safety about tomorrow's planned demonstration in the District of Columbia. So I'd like to start with a call we got from Joanne, who couldn't stay on the line. Can't the D.C. Attorney General sue these domestic terrorist organizations on behalf of Capitol Hill residents for threatening our right to life, liberty, and happiness? Their actions are denying freedoms by preventing safe use of the neighborhood and of Capitol grounds. How would you respond to that, Carl Racine?
I heard her question. I thought her comments were picture perfect, and certainly empathize with them. We at the Office of Attorney General have actually met with residents of Capitol Hill. We understand the trauma and terror that they experienced, and we certainly understand the damage that was inflicted on the Metropolitan Police Department and many of its officers. What I can tell the D.C. resident is that we're quite aware of the lawsuits to date that have been brought against these groups. We ourselves are doing our work to ascertain whether we can bring such a lawsuit. We, of course, would only do so if we could prevail. So that's where we are. We're looking at that question.
Mr. Attorney General, I'll follow up on that. After the January 6th riots on Capitol Hill, you told us your office was looking into the possible misdemeanor charges of inciting to riot, up to and even possibly including President Trump for inciting those riots with what he said and did. You thought at the time that there was, quote, compelling evidence, but you said, and meanwhile, the U.S. attorney has charged about 500 people for participating in the riot. Where does your investigation stand? Are you close to making the decision on January 6th? Have you decided that you will not bring charges for January 6th, but you'll be looking at whatever happens in the next couple of days?
Sure. And Tom, I think you accurately stated, as you always do, what my prior comments were focused on. What my prior comments were focused on, as distinct from the caller's question, was the issue of criminal liability under D.C. law that the Office of Attorney General could bring based on the events of January 6th. Let me just give you a brief update there. As you know, my office is limited. We have only misdemeanor authority over adults. There is a charge that is an interesting charge. That's a DC misdemeanor offense, inciting a riot. I believe there's compelling evidence that there were individuals who incited a riot. The last thing that I'd want to do as a local prosecutor here is to somehow get ahead of the federal government in regards to charges that are more serious that it might bring. Quite aware of the statute of limitations that obtains to our misdemeanor offenses. And so we are observing what the feds are going to do. At an appropriate time, depending on what their action, we may go forward.
They certainly have charged over 500 people. People have pled guilty. There have been agreements. I don't think any have actually gone to trial yet. So the federal government seems to be doing a good job. Do you think it's doing a good job?
You know, it's a hard question. I've been looking at the prosecutions. We have assigned lawyers who look at this every single day. I can tell you that while I'm pleased that there have been a number of successful guilty pleas, I am concerned, just as federal judges in D.C. express concern at what appears to be pretty low sentences. We're talking about time served, probation, home detention, and equally troubling, low fines. The caller made a great point about the significant financial damage that the January 6th protesters caused district residents and even the U.S. Capitol. I'm with the federal judges who have expressed concern about what appears to be, to some, including me, somewhat light treatment in regards to the amount of money that the folks are required to pay, the fines.
Your office sued Amazon in May over allegations that the tech giant is controlling prices. Can you explain what's in the original lawsuit and why you decided to expand it this month?
Sure, Tom, and thanks for the question. Antitrust law is usually viewed as, kind of esoteric, complicated. It's got principles of economics in it, and people just kind of go to sleep when they hear the term antitrust. Here's the way I look at antitrust law. Antitrust law is about making sure that companies engage in competition so that consumers can benefit from goods and services at the lowest price and receive also the best services. Here's the problem that we're seeing with Amazon and why we initially brought suit and added to our complaint. We know, and I should be upfront here, I'm an Amazon Prime member, okay? I benefit from.
Who isn't?
That's my point. We are all damn near Amazon Prime members. Amazon dominates the online retail space. Experts estimate that they have 50 to 70% of the market. The number two and number three players, eBay and Walmart, at best combined make up 10% of the marketplace. So what we allege is that Amazon is using its clear and overwhelming market power to make deals with third-party sellers that ensure that Amazon makes the most profit it can, but that these third-party sellers are prohibited from selling their goods on other channels at a lower cost. We think that is an abuse of their monopoly power. The added a charge that we added just last week relates to the agreements that Amazon makes with wholesalers. They actually require wholesalers to guarantee Amazon a certain profit margin. If the wholesalers sell their products, in other words, on other platforms at a lower price, the wholesalers have to actually come out of pocket to ensure that Amazon doesn't have to lower its prices to match the lower price. That, in my view, is a violation of antitrust laws, and I'm looking forward to a D.C. Superior Court holding them to account.
Is this your office doing this? I know you've participated in any number of joint suits with other attorneys general around the nation. Is this one you're doing yourself, or is this part of a group of attorneys general?
This is a homegrown D.C. lawsuit filed by the Office of Attorney General for the District of Columbia in the D.C. Superior Court.
Okay. Can I ask the political question just so we can get it out of the way now?
Let's do one more lawsuit thing first, because your office has filed a civil complaint against Terrence Boyle of Delta Phi Epsilon's Alpha Chapter, Georgetown University. You're alleging that he improperly arranged to sell the chapter house last year. In addition to telling us more about the complaint, even though the article in the Washington Post tells us a great deal, one of the things that stood out to me was that the attorney for Mr. Boyle, Harvey Volza, said, "It's a crying shame that, quote unquote, these clowns brought this suit. He, meaning you, has no good faith factual basis for that complaint. And he, meaning you, is lucky that he has immunity from defamation suits because he is the AG." How would you respond to that?
Well, I've been called worst, first of all. And I do appreciate a sense of humor, but I can tell you that our fine lawyers and non-lawyer professionals are not clowns. We take our ethical obligations seriously, and we would only file a suit that alleges misuse of nonprofit monies for one's personal benefit if we had the facts to prove it. One way to prove it all up is for you, Tom, and others to follow the course of the lawsuit. I can promise you that what you'll find at the end of the day is we're going to prevail because our evidence is overwhelming.
Okay, well, Bill Rice, whom we all know, tweeted Tom's next question.
Well, he's tweeted it 10 times to me, but I already had it. And let's just do the. I have some other issues about the forensics lab and some other issues, abortion
sure.
issues, but I want to get to you.
Because this is the politics.
You are the Hamlet of D.C. politics in terms of announcing your next move. You are technically running for a third term as Attorney General, although you told the University of the District of Columbia in March, which I happened to listen to that speech, and I asked the question, you answered it, that you didn't think you would run for Attorney General again. And as you said, quote, let somebody else do it, that you thought you had done well and would maybe do something else. You have been mentioned for running for mayor for 6 years, I think, now. And you haven't decided on what there is. And some people are telling me you're going to return to private practice. You have a new family, a new home, and you're just going to go back to private practice. But as you know, I tweeted this last week that you are potentially going to be the new ambassador to Haiti. The current ambassador, or the former ambassador, Michelle Cisson, I think is the way she says her name, is a career State Department employee. She has been moved back to the State Department in an undersecretary position. The Haiti post is open. Are you under consideration for it? Can you say anything about it?
Let me try to answer those 11 questions.
I was just giving the history of my haranguing you.
I know. And look here, I also appreciate the fact that it's fair and appropriate for you to question. Let me just tackle the Haiti question first. Look, I love Haiti. I'm from Haiti. I care deeply about the history and the people there. I would do anything in this world to help my fellow Haitians. I have not had conversations with the White House about an ambassador role with Haiti. Haiti, generally speaking, has been viewed as a country where a career diplomat is required, given the complicated nature of the relationship between Haiti and the District of Columbia. So on that point, Tom, there actually is nothing that I can add. With respect to my current political plans, I too, kind of get frustrated with my own self. I would like to make a final and firm decision and make it public. Here's the deal. I'm not there yet. I love my current job. I'm serving DC residents every day, trying as best we can to give a voice to those who don't always have one. And I'm not yet ready to announce my plans. So that's the truth.
Okay, so despite what you said, I think it was March at the UDC when asked about your plans, and you gave a very fulsome answer, but said you didn't think you would want to run for attorney general again, you are technically an active candidate for a third term. Is that still on the table or off the table, attorney general third term?
That's fair. I think, you know, at this point, I think it would be most accurate to say that, you know, all of the options are on the table. I do want to say a couple of other things, if I can, politically. Here it is. Look, the Office of Attorney General and my colleagues have been extraordinary over the last 6.5 years. We had two goals. Use the law to help our most vulnerable residents in the District of Columbia, and build an office that the District of Columbia could be proud of, and an office that would be seen as amongst the strongest in the country. Because of the work of my colleagues, I think we've established that. I'm also proud of the four former Attorney General office colleagues who now sit on the City Council. And I expect amongst those four people, you're gonna have future Attorneys General. You're gonna have future council chairman of the council, and you're gonna have a future mayor. That may or may not include me, but I'm really proud of the people. They're talented. They care about the District of Columbia.
Okay, that's why I was hoping you would get upset about them being referred to as clowns, but go ahead.
I just want to say before people forget what you just said, that sounded like a valedictory statement to me.
Okay.
Well, not having been ever the number one person in my class, I don't know what the form of such a statement is, and I was just speaking the truth as to the reverence I have for my colleagues, including those who serve on the council.
Okay, unless Kojo has a caller or something, I have another issue.
Well, back to the track on the lawsuits against companies. Lauren sent us an email. Is there something the Attorney General's office can do about Uber surge pricing? It doesn't seem like it should be legal for them to charge more than $30 to go 1 mile.
You know, I got to tell you, I think that is a fair question by the resident there. I myself, and you all may have seen this to the extent that you use Uber, especially have seen, you know, outrageously high surge pricing. I can tell you that concern resonates with me, and we're going to go and take a look at that. The other thing to note, you know, sometimes we do bring a lot of lawsuits. They bring publicity. Oftentimes, Tom and Kojo, when we call and meet with a company and raise concerns like the surge pricing, we get a lot of information that either tells us that they were doing something wrong or that they're not doing anything wrong at all. Even sometimes, the companies go ahead and fix the problem so that we don't have to bring a lawsuit. I can assure this resident and anyone who files any consumer complaint with our office that we're going to take a hard look at this issue.
Okay. I haven't used Uber because the prices are ridiculous now. I find my bike works better. Let me ask you, we talked about it briefly with the deputy mayor of public safety. The forensics science lab here in the district, the deputy mayor Geldart said that they were moving to outsource the gun investigations. I'm sure you've paid attention to the problems over there. They lost accreditation. Do you have any concerns that the forensics lab is not able to do its job?
Well, I thought your question and your predicate set forth the history really well, and I was actually quite encouraged by the deputy mayor's response. You know, sadly, for nearly a year, the response that we were getting out of the executive regarding DFS was that there is no problem, that somehow, some way, U.S. Attorney's Office and even my office is playing politics with the Department of Forensic Services. Of course, that wasn't true. And that's why they lost their accreditation. Now I think the focus has to be on ascertaining whether, number one, we need an independent lab, and two, if so, how do we get it back to the of accreditation that it needs.
Okay, I thought I gave you a chance to answer that question because I thought if you really attack the mayor's and executive office of the mayor, there'd be a sign whether you're going to run for mayor or not, but you didn't fall into the trap.
I credited Chris, who I like.
I know, Deputy Mayor. You were fine.
Credited him. Okay.
The district continues to see shootings. Homicides are up 13% compared to this time last year. In 2018, you launched a violence interruption program, Cure the Streets. Can you talk about how that program is going? Is it helping?
Sure. Indeed. Back in 2017, again, there was just an incredibly painful spree of violent crime, including murders. Numerous council members were irate, even called at that point in 2017 for the mayor to declare a crime emergency. Look, we've been studying effective ways to enhance public safety ever since we got in office. We became aware of a Cure the Streets type program where violence interrupters, who are credible messengers, actually go into the areas where there is crime and try as best they can to divert people away from committing crime. So we've been up and going now for 3 years in five locations. I'm really happy that the council has allocated additional monies to us so that we can extend the geographic areas within which CURE operates. I can tell you that based on the last year of full statistics, the geographic areas where Cure the Street was present, violent crime dropped by 13% and homicides by 47%. The early indication is that Cure is a complement, not a replacement, to the Metropolitan Police Department. And it is another way for us to reduce the violence. I'm hopeful that at the end of this pilot phase of Cure the Streets, the city will have enough information to decide whether to expend more monies in violence prevention.
You didn't weigh in too much on defund the police movements last year. You certainly didn't, to my knowledge, support them. And the council wrestled over them, and they've cut back. The council cut back the mayor's urgent request to hire more police more quickly, saying the police are not going to solve crime alone. Even Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member, says you got to have both the police and crime reduction public strategies to get control of the crime in the city. Are you confident that the police are properly staffed? Do you agree with the mayor that she should hire more quickly?
We only have about 30 seconds left, Mr. Attorney General.
Mm. Sure. Look, I have great confidence in Chief Conte, who I've known for decades. I certainly would be attentive to what Chief Conte believes is necessary in order to keep the city safe. I think where we have not focused well enough over the last few years, where crime and murders have been increasing, go to Anacostia, ask people in Anacostia, go to Ward 4, talk about Kennedy Street, we know 7 and 8, is on a comprehensive plan that not only focuses on law enforcement, but also on innovation like Cure the Streets,
and then focuses
deeply on trying to impact the lives of young people.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
There you have a mayor campaign.
Carl Racine is the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Thank you for joining us. A special thank you to Nancy Gass, who was our phone screener today. Nancy and I went on an expedition to try to figure out who locked me out of my office. Fortunately, we finally got it open. Great to see you, Nancy. And I'd like to encourage you all to stay tuned. In a couple of minutes, you'll hear a recording of our latest Kojo in Our Community event on how the pandemic has impacted local businesses in our region. It was and is a fascinating conversation. Tom Sherwood, I know what you're doing this weekend.
Yes, I'm going to see the flags, and I'm going to the demonstration tomorrow.
Thank you all for listening, and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nan.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Kenny Pirog. Mona Cashby oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.